following programming is sponsored by Clean and Sober Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio, brought to you in part by Recovery Centers of America, the nationally recognized leader in drug and alcohol treatment, using proven evidence-based treatment, including 24/7 medically supervised detox, inpatient and outpatient options. You'll receive exceptional care from an expert team of master-level clinicians, physicians, nurses, and staff using 12-step methodology and medications. Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region, a proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825, and Acadia Healthcare, with locations on the East Coast. Acadia maintains a standard for excellence in the treatment of behavioral health and addiction concerns. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Hendler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about addiction to drugs and alcohol. Mark, what is new this week in recovery news?
We got some interesting news. Johnny Depp, who's currently at a trial, it's coming out that he spent $100,000 every month to David Kipper, a doctor Depp hired in 2014 to help treat addiction issues. Depp said that he became dependent on opioid medication following a leg injury. Former money manager testified on Thursday that Johnny Depp's history of addiction and attempts to detoxify have come to light during this substances such as alcohol, benzos, opiates, and stimulants. He's been in and out of recovery.
Yeah, but maybe he's not. He's in a divorce battle right now, and maybe he's not thinking so clearly.
I would think so. I mean, he might be clean now. I'm not so sure. He has been in and out of recovery is what's coming out.
All right. What else you got?
So as New Jersey marks 1 month since recreational cannabis was legalized, South Jersey animal hospitals are seeing a spike in dogs accidentally ingesting marijuana. Rothman's Animal Hospital, Dr. Monique Cerinci, says that they've seen more and more dogs with marijuana toxicosis, especially due to these edible products. They may get lethargic, wobbly, dribbly urine. Treatment includes fluids, anti-nausea meds, and medications that treat vertigo.
Okay, so this is the irresponsibility of pet owners, obviously.
Yeah, well, supposedly some dogs are just out for walks and they find edibles on the ground,
right?
And they're getting this.
Right. When you first started this, I thought they were smoking doobies on their own.
Yeah, no doobies. You know, some of these edibles, they look good to dogs.
Sure.
So, you know, they
sure.
see them up on the counter, they pull them down and they eat a whole bunch. But it's a shame because you look at it and like these dogs are really suffering.
Well, of course, it's irresponsible owners. Like there's so many people out there.
We're just going to see more and more things from this legal weed in Jersey come to light. So.
Well, all over the country we're going to see this. And we're already starting to see it.
Yeah, we are. We are.
You know, when we come back from our first break, I have a very interesting story about a guy who had carpal tunnel issues. That's issues with the wrists and stuff. And he goes to a, I don't know what kind of doctor, and the guy puts him on opioids. Okay, now all hell breaks loose. He's driving in his car. He hadn't used he was on opioids, so he started smoking weed. And 6 days prior to being pulled over, he smoked for the last time. But they found THC in his blood. He lost his license for a year. So again, as we talk about it a lot, this is a big problem across this country, regulating and deciding who is high and who isn't high. And it's real complicated.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. Pennsylvania has a zero tolerance law. So it's quite possible in Pennsylvania that somebody could have smoked, you know, 3 weeks before and get a DUI. And that's probably the same thing in this state where with this.
Great story. It's unbelievable. Hey, listen, we're going to take our first break. And we come back. We're coming back with Sarah Laurel. And Sarah is the founder and executive director of Savage Sisters, an incredible organization. And we'll find all about this organization when we come back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're struggling with alcohol or drugs, Recovery Centers of America can help. RCA's local inpatient and outpatient programs are founded on science and delivered with heart from an expert, caring team who will inspire and guide you every step of the way. Call 1-888-RECOVERY now to speak with a treatment advisor. At RCA, you'll be in a community that builds connections and fosters support from peers and RCA's team of medical professionals and recovery support specialists. At RCA's state-of-the-art campuses in Devon, PA, and Mays Landing, New Jersey, they tailor your treatment to you and also offer specialized programs for patients with history of trauma, for patients who have achieved recovery but are experiencing a relapse, for young adults, adults 50 years and older, a confidential program for first responders and military, and a faith-based program. RCA answers the phone and accepts patients 24/7. And because it's local and in-network with insurance providers, treatment is affordable and accessible. Don't wait. Call 1-888-RECOVERY. Recovery today.
Hey, this is Darryl Strawberry, and you're listening to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Also, we are heard on these great stations across America. We're on WWDB in Philadelphia, KDWN Las Vegas, Nevada, WHFS Tampa, Florida, and WGAC Augusta, Georgia. All right, so let me just read a little headline for you, Sarah, and we'll go from there. Once left for dead, this Philadelphia woman is helping those battle addiction. Laura, who was born and raised in South Philadelphia, was a successful account executive for a hotel chain, eventually rising to director of sales. She was making good money and living a comfortable life. She owned a home. She had a kid. She was thriving. Then in her mid-whatever age, Laura began suffering from carpal tunnel syndrome, an ailment for which doctors prescribed opioids. That's when Laura said her life sentence began with addiction. Hey, man, thank you and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you've been had, let me tell you. No. Okay, so look, I read up a little bit about you. You do incredible work. You're another example of us who have gone through hell and have gotten clean, gotten sober, and then more importantly, have given back to the community because we've been given so much. So, thank you for your work. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what your family life was like, Sarah.
We grew up, I went to St. Monica's in South Philly. I have a pretty big family. My mom's Irish Catholic. My dad's actually Middle Eastern. So there was a pretty heavy moral code within our household. I think that they were wonderful parents, and there was nothing super traumatic that took place in my life that would have dictated the way that I ended up. We did move out to the county, and I went to Radnor High School in 10th grade. I did not like that. and then I went back to South Philly a couple years later and worked at a hotel chain.
Okay. And things were
great in my opinion.
In your opinion.
Yeah. I was doing well. I had a nice place and I had a decent car and I was raising my son and making decent money. And then I, started experiencing some pain. And I went to a mainline doctor, actually. And
No names.
I don't remember his name, honestly.
Okay.
And then I started with the opioids. I wouldn't say I was completely naive to what was going on, but I became very chemically dependent upon them.
How fast? I'm so curious about how fast people become addicted with the drugs that are available today.
I don't know because I didn't realize what was happening, I don't think. I had taken them as a prescribed medication for over a year, probably closer to 2 years. And then I was just completely cut off. There was no warning shot. It was just, you're no longer getting this medication. And I had friends. I mean, I grew up in South Philly, so I knew all about, perks and all that stuff. So I just reached out to a friend who I knew about it and started getting them on the street. And once I started getting them on the street, within, I would say, a year, I was already moved on to heroin.
So my question is, and Mark, I mean, we talk about this a lot. What kind of doctor puts somebody on opioids for 2 years? Got a creep.
Well, and then especially does not help you taper down. So you're saying the doctor just cut you off with no taper or anything. And did you go into withdrawal at that point?
I did not feel well, but I don't believe at that time that I knew that I was dope sick, as we call it now. I did not feel well. And I had also, from the same doctor, started getting a prescription for Adderall. So I just took extra Adderall because I was feeling very sick and tired. I did not realize it at the time. But it eventually, like, the substances were – I had no control.
Were you doctor shopping?
No.
Just one doctor?
Just one doctor.
Was there any history of any drug use before that? Were you, you know, smoking pot or doing acid or –
I smoked pot rarely, and I drank, I would say, responsibly. Once I had the pills coming in, it was just downhill. Yeah, I just couldn't. It just changed everything. It was a game changer for me.
So in 2015 in the state of Pennsylvania, and for our listeners and viewers in other states, I'm sure you have the same situation, the prescription monitoring program was initiated out of Harrisburg, which was to control doctors writing multiple prescriptions for this stuff, and also for pharmacists filling them. Is that about the time? It started in 2015, but it's been continuing. I think 2017, 2018, a lot of doctors were getting the message, you better be careful.
So I was already, for me personally, I was doing heroin by that point. I started doing heroin, I think it was 2013. Mm-hmm. And 2015, if I remember correctly, I was in jail. So I don't know. I know that there's a trend. I do a Narcan training and an overdose prevention training, and I know that there's a big trend in pharmaceutical prescriptions going down around that time, and that's where you see an increase in heroin and fentanyl.
Okay.
That definitely was a game changer for everybody involved in drugs.
Yeah. I mean, for our listeners and viewers in other states, there's an area of Philadelphia called Kensington, and it's sort of the ground zero for sure in Philadelphia, if not the East Coast, for addiction at the lowest levels of despair that is openly presented on the streets in that area in Kensington. And I know that you do a lot of work in that area. Tell us, what is it like? Try to give a visual picture. What is it like in Kensington?
So I was homeless down there, but I also lived down there as a sober human doing outreach. It's two parts. There is a beautiful community that surrounds the area that has been underserved and not taken care of and has had a complete lack of resources for decades. And then there is a community, because of the open air drug market, it's, I believe, the largest in America, open air drug market. There is not really a way to describe it. Everything is out in the open. You can smoke publicly, inject publicly. They don't have access to resources such as public restrooms and showers. So you can imagine that a large population of individuals that are unhoused and don't have access to public restrooms and showers and are actively using substances, it's a very sad situation. And with the xylazine, you're seeing a lot of individuals with open sores and wounds.
Will you explain what xylazine is to our listeners?
Xylazine is an animal-grade tranquilizer that is in 91% of the dope supply in Philly. So as we know, all these counties surrounding Philly, Bucks, Mocco, Delco, Chester, most individuals that aren't staying in Kensington, they come to Kensington, they cop and roll, and they go home. So anybody that purchases or gets their dope supply from Philly, there's a high likelihood that they are consuming xylazine. it has very high sedative effects, and it is not, it doesn't matter the way that you consume the substance, whether you inject, smoke, or snort it. It is causing open wounds and lesions on the skin, so bad that tissue is being exposed and sometimes amputations are necessary.
You know, it's interesting. So people that are listening or watching or just thinking today, they would say to themselves, and this is a common thing, oh my God, knowing that this can happen to you, why would anybody use these substances? I mean, it's such a ridiculous statement, but I hear it a lot. You know, it's just like, you know, just say no, which is beyond stupid. It's an incredible your brain, I believe, and I'm no neurosurgeon, becomes wired in such a different way that allows you to rationalize or conduct yourself in a way that you would never, ever do if you were not addicted to drugs. And I got to tell you, Kensington, you ever been down there?
Yeah, just
unbelievable. And I'm just so disgusted that this city can't get this straight.
Yeah, and I you know, I was going to ask you, Sarah, what, so you were homeless down there. What was that like? I don't want to bring up bad memories, but did you have to like find places to sleep every night? I mean, what was there a lot of people homeless too?
Yeah, there was a lot of homeless people. Most times I slept in a trap house. Just like a bunch of – there was no running water or electricity, but
– That's an abandoned house? Is that what that is?
Yeah. So I wasn't usually like outside. On the nights that I was outside, I definitely didn't sleep. You know, you have to stay alert and stay aware. I was assaulted several times. I was stabbed. You know, you don't – just like if – and I ran alone, so it was different being homeless. It's hot. You're just – that whatever the elements are delivering is like kind of how your day goes. If it's raining, you want to seek some kind of shelter in that way. If it's hot, you know, you want to get into a cool shaded area. If it's cold, you want to try and find warmth. But you kind of deal with it as best that you can.
When you were going through that, was your mind in a place where you said, I don't want to do this anymore. I got to get out of here. Or were you, this is what it is. And
I think it depended on the situation. If I was well, if I was high, I was cool. I didn't care what the elements didn't bother me. There were days where I felt fed up and I just was exhausted and I was like, I'm going to get sober. But there was the dope sickness and like the uneasiness of like the mental warfare that took place when I would be separated from drugs. Like I just always went right back to it. I couldn't deal with it. My mind wasn't in the right state at that time, you know.
Where'd you get money?
Illegally.
Prostitution?
No, I was not a prostitute.
Was when you were, how did you end up getting kind of trapped down there? Were you just going down to cop and then eventually you were just like, it's here, I might as well stay?
Yeah, it just became easier. So there's this kind of energy as an IV drug user. The only reason I would really come to the counties was to, you know, I mean, I have burglaries on my record, so allegedly, you know, get some money and go back. Once I got there, I could inject wherever I wanted. There was no judgment. I could do the drugs that I wanted to do without the judgment of other people. It's where everybody's sin is on the outside. It's where everybody can just be as ugly and dark as they want to be, and nobody's going to judge it.
What about your family?
They weren't there. I'm in Kensington. They were there for me. They loved me. That's not what I mean. I mean, the reason I stayed in Kensington was because they weren't there. It was because I was surrounded by people who just let me be in the space that I – that was where I wanted to be. I wanted to be high.
Yeah. Hey, if you're just joining us and you want to watch the show as we do it live, it's 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on Facebook. Go to our page, Clean and Sober Radio. Just like viewers today, Bob Moeller is watching. Patty Weeks. Mike Hepp. Yo, bro. Jan Olaf Atterborn. Bob Mahler says, good afternoon, Friday guys. Great. What's DAT mean?
I think that he might have mixed up the Y and the T.
Great day. Is that
great
what you're saying?
Great day, yes.
All right,
I
it is a great day.
That's what happened.
Laura's story. Great day to be listening to Clean and Sober. Michael Siberia, Hope Cornfield, Bessler, Fred Beach. Let's see who else. We'll get back to Hank Brewer. We'll get back to these. Oh, Judge Maddox is watching. Taking a break from court. Just wanted to check in to say hi. Great show. Thanks, Judge. Good.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for bringing kind of some clarity to this, because, you know, we were talking before the show about shame and about so it was almost like there was this community, even though it surrounded drugs, where there wasn't like shame.
Mm-hmm.
But that's correct. That was the reality. But that's not. What am I going to say? In simplest terms, that's not right.
But you could kind of just see how if you have this full blown addiction, there's lots of stigma around. But then
Absolutely.
There's this community where, hey, I can do this You're out accepted. In the open, yes. And you know, you could just see how that's attractive to people.
It's like a club. Any club you want to feel a part of without judgment.
I think more or less, I just did not want to be told that what I was doing was wrong. I think that we forget that individuals in that space aren't stupid. Most of the addicts that I know are pretty highly intelligent. They understand that the world judges the behavior of using substances. We understand that you don't like it, that it's not pretty, and that it's a human behavior that everybody can point a finger at and say bad. We get that. We don't do it for lack of knowledge or any of that. We do it because we're chemically dependent on it. And at that point, the shame attached to it does not help anybody get sober. Shame has never been a reason that somebody's gotten sober. Neither has parenthood. Neither has judicial system consequences. None of these things enforce sobriety. What actually kept me sober was connection to humans. Once I got thrown out of a window in Kensington and I was in a wheelchair and I had to sit still, I started building relationships with women and they connected to me. And I stayed connected to mental health resources and to a 12-step fellowship. And that is how I got to really tap into a foundation of sobriety, connection. So shame has never been anything except for a way to dig a deeper hole.
Well, but I do say, you know, the legal system can be an incentive to get clean and not use again. I've seen plenty of people do that.
I don't think you can arrest your way out of this one.
Well, I don't think you can arrest your way on a mass scale, but people do, some people do, get out of the addiction in different ways. And one of them, at least I found for me and a lot of my friends who have very long, very long recovery, the legal system stopped them. They didn't want to go back to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, and, you know, so you said you were thrown out of a second floor window?
Mm-hmm.
Was that just like another person using or?
Nope. That was just a situation I found myself in the middle of the night in Kensington. And I got into an altercation with three gentlemen and it got escalated. And then I was taken to a vacant lot. And that was how I ended up getting sober 5 years ago. My leg was separated from my hip bone. My knee was crushed. My ankles were broken. It was insane. But I sat in the hospital for weeks and then I was wheeled into a meeting and I had to sit still long enough that I was able to realize that I could take a sober breath.
Yeah. And you remember that like defining moment when you probably said, okay, I got to change. I'm going to change.
I don't. I don't think it was a defining moment. I think that it was a lot of pain and a lot of suffering and a lot of self-doubt. But it was – so I don't paint a picture of a pink cloud. I paint a picture of stay strong.
Okay.
And just breathe through it one day at a time.
Okay. We've been talking to Sarah Laurel. She is the executive director and founder of Savage Sisters, and she has an incredible story which she is telling you now. And if this story doesn't scare the hell out of you, I don't know what will. And we'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Don't let addiction rob you of one more day. Pocono Mountain Recovery Center offers comprehensive addiction treatment for adults. Depending on your unique needs, your care at Pocono Mountain may include detox, residential treatment, and an array of outpatient options. We also offer transitional living support and transportation for outpatient participants. Pocono Mountain is in network with most major insurance plans. Start your recovery journey at Pocono Mountain Recovery Center. To learn more, call 877-596-0223.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
We're back. You know, Mark, Sarah's story is, it's not unique, but there's a lot of people out there who have been suffering or still suffering. You know, the visual of being in a neighborhood in Philadelphia or anywhere else where you're thrown out of a window, you can watch people shoot up other people, shoot up themselves. There's no bathrooms. So outside, apparently there's no showers, no nothing. What a burden to live with. Look, we both have our degree of addiction craziness. But, you know, as you say a lot, you know, bottoms are different for everybody. And I'm just so grateful that I didn't have to hit a bottom like that. And I'm so grateful for people like Sarah who have come out of it and are helping people who where she once was.
Yeah, and, you know, when I hear these stories, I start to think, too, what do we need to do? You know, do we need to go more of a harm reduction kind of thing? You know, do we need to figure out what's going on down there? And you know, maybe it is, I mean, it's like a bad word a lot of times. Maybe it is safe injection sites. Maybe it is, you know, big time harm reduction. And I was interested, Sarah, in what you think about that after living it and then being on the other side of it. Do you feel like we're doing things wrong that's led to this, or do you think we need a sort of a harm reduction approach?
So I'm a huge harm reductionist, and I think that we need to change that narrative in order to save lives. Part of the reason that we have 91% of our dope supply with xylazine is because we don't have a safe supply, whereas prohibition with alcohol years ago, people died because it was gin made in a bathtub. Yeah. So now we have safe consumption sites known as bars, and you get a particular amount for a particular price, and it's safe and you can consume it. And if you drink too much, they take your keys. The same could be said about any substance. People that were addicted to opioids aren't even getting opioids anymore. They're getting whatever the corner boy puts in their bag. So safe supply means that if I want to use an opioid, I will actually get an opioid. The chances that I'll have something laced with fentanyl or xylazine start to lower, which means we have less deaths. And that's what we want. We want less dead kids. That's what I think the goal is here. And as far as calling it a safe consumption site, I don't call it a safe consumption site. It's an overdose prevention site. So if you're going to consume, that's none of my business. That's your human right. And as we have seen through the number of human beings that use substances, people who use drugs, they will consume it. It's just a matter of whether or not they will do it safely and whether or not there will be somebody there to prevent a deadly overdose.
Well, I think I think I agree with you almost totally. The consumption of narcotics and stuff can lead to really bad criminal activity. For the sake of getting drugs, getting money for drugs, like we hear, at least in our city, every night 5-6 people are shot to death for money. I'm assuming some of that money is for drugs. And so I agree with you. If somebody wants to get high and it does not affect anybody else, I think that's fine. But unfortunately, I think that a lot of this crime has to do with narcotics.
Yeah, and a lot of the crime has to do with the price and the needing the money for it, right?
Well, yes, you're backing into your right. My thing is, you know, every city has enough money that if they want to, I don't know if the word is control, but make it better for people, they can. I just don't know why they don't.
Yeah, and you really have to look at things right now with. It's almost like we need to look at taking a complete U-turn on this. I mean, I think there was 106,000 people died or something last year from overdose.
That's just reported. Yeah.
That's just reported. And you have to wonder, it's getting worse every single year,
yep.
You know, and you have to wonder, like it's almost like we need to take really drastic actions.
My question is, our country is so advanced that we can find a man in a cave across the ocean, but we can't figure out how to control a 5-block radius in Philadelphia County and the drug supply infiltrating it that is literally devastating this state. So where is the help at?
You're 100% right. It's so absurd. Look, in the last 2 years, we found an antibody to COVID like in a month. And as Sarah said, I don't know how many blocks it is in Philly or any other city. I can't even wrap my head around it why more isn't being done. Unless, you know, the people that make decisions or the politicians, maybe they need to have some of their family addicted to make them switch their views.
It's a million dollar. There are $1 million corners in Kensington, $1 million corners. So there's money being made, and it's on the expense of the safety of the residential community that has been not protected, not taken care of. Because I guarantee you, if I went into Wayne right now and tried to inject publicly, I would be immediately apprehended.
Yes, so you would.
It is a calculated situation, and it's unfortunately we are targeting the people that are using drugs, and we are, you know, causing. There's this situation where we're saying, "Oh, it's them; they're bad," but we're not looking at why are they here. Nobody's coming to Kensington for free syringes or sandwiches. People are coming to Kensington for the drugs. It's not that big. Philadelphia is a small city, and Kensington's a small section of a small city. So. I don't know. Figure it out.
Well, you know, Sarah, I've always said that or thought and I'll tell you why I said this because I sit on the Pennsylvania Department of Drugs and Alcohol Council. Guy said – I've told this story so many times. He said, I'm a sheriff in York County, Pennsylvania, somewhere out there. And I thought all you people were this, that, and that until my son came home and said he was a heroin addict. Bang. That's what it took for him, and I think that takes. I think that says a lot for people. Really, don't care unless it directly affects them. Unfortunately.
Well, I think that we have to start talking about this, and this is one of the things that Savage Sisters is doing, and harm reduction, taking that tired old adage of the stigma around it. These are conversations that are had in the home. We are undoing harm from the DARE program. We are undoing stigma from decades of training that we've indoctrinated into our society that drugs are bad, okay? When really we need to be talking about connecting people to resources. And it was similar to how the HIV crisis ushered in sex education in the public school system. Well, this unfortunate situation is going to usher in this dialogue where we're going to say, people are going to use drugs, and here's how to do it safely. 99,000 people died from alcohol-related deaths. Alcohol is a drug. Okay, so we already have legal drugs in America. We already have them, and the top leading killers in this country are all legal. So know that if we have a safe supply and we have options for individuals to use as safely as possible, we can do one thing for sure, and that's have less dead kids. And I think that should be our goal. Yeah.
Agreed. How does it happen, though? It's legislatures. It's politicians. It's grassroots.
We don't have to, though. We can educate within the schools. We can take accountability for our own township. Give us a call. Call Savage Sisters. We'll come out. We'll have a conversation about harm reduction. We'll give you the supplies that you need. I'm not here to change the world. I'm here for my community, this 5-county borough that I work in, this area, you know, Philly, Delco, Monco, Bucks. Like, if you're hearing this, if you're listening to this, get on the phone. Get somebody out there. Talk about overdose prevention, overdose reversal, what drugs look like, what it does to your body, how to get help, mental health resources. Have a conversation about it and don't shy away from it. Take the initiative yourself. That's how it starts. I can't change the laws. Not right now.
Well, and you know, one of these things, I mean, you've lived it, right? You've lived it. You were out there in Kensington. I always find like that's the best place to get the suggestion on how we take care of this. And You know, a couple months ago, we were talking about when a lot of the drug companies settled a lawsuit, and we had a lawyer that was connected to that who was saying out of the whatever billions, there was only 10% of the money going towards helping with the addiction problem.
Yeah. That was Rob Reed from the Attorney General's office. And yeah, a small percentage of that lawsuit will actually go to be helping.
Yeah, and the rest is going to lawyers and businesses.
Of course. And
when you read in the papers, it's like money for the opioid, to address the opioid epidemic. And it was like, I forget how much it was, but it was billions of dollars.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Billions of dollars. Listen, if you need help, we have a number for you to call right now. The U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-HELP. If you're struggling or you have a family member struggling, give them a call. These phones are manned by trained people in this field to help you get some kind of relief through resources.
Yeah. And we always say it every week, get it early, right? Get it early. Get treatment early.
Get it any way you can.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Get it any way you can.
I mean, my thing is I'm just so upset with the politicians because ultimately they change. They might not be the ones that are making they make the change with the help of other people, but it's their votes that actually make the change. And I don't think most of them really care.
Yeah. I mean, you know, big changes have to happen. And but I was interested. So you got clean after being thrown out of this window, hitting a bottom, right? And how did you like maintain your recovery at that point? Was it through 12 step? Was it through?
I did do a 12 step fellowship. I still do a 12-step fellowship, and I did experience a relapse in 2019, so I just celebrated 3 years of continuous sobriety.
Amazing.
After starting Savage Sisters, a few things took place, and I had a mental health crisis, and I chose to pick up one weekend. Luckily, my family was there and really supported me through it, and we just kind of kept it moving right afterwards, but I do have a sponsor and a home group, and I go to meetings every day still because I need them.
And you lost, you said when you had that relapse, you lost somebody very close to you, right?
My partner at the time, Pete, died, and I tried to Narcan him and do rescue breathing, and he did not make it, so.
Sarah, tell us about Savage Sisters. Tell us What does Savage Sisters actually do?
So we do three things.
Okay.
We have 6 sober living homes in Philadelphia, 3 for men and 3 for women. All of our houses offer free dual diagnosis trauma therapy from private practitioners, kickboxing weekly, and in-house yoga. We also do other modalities of healing, such as ecotherapy, nutritional specialists. We partner with female-founded and led nonprofits to offer these resources to all of our residents. We also have our street-based outreach where we distribute harm reduction kits, Narcan. We do wound care for individuals that are housing insecure and have those lesions from xylazine, food, clothing, and cold water. Tomorrow's a code red. And then we also do overdose prevention, harm reduction, and reversal training across the state. We've traveled.
So you're a 501c3?
Yes.
So your funding comes from?
We have not received any funding from the government yet. We've had private donors. Big shout out to some of the Strauss Foundation has helped us. Dakota, which has really helped us. We got something from the DA's office. And then we have private donors from Delco mainly that actually have made significant donations to keep us going. But all of our work is done via community support.
It's amazing
that
you've kept this going.
Yeah.
Because it's not easy to raise money.
Even
for really good causes, it's not easy.
It's not easy. And I mean, to be fair, for 4 years running, our team was all volunteers, myself included. Last year was the first year that I actually got paid, and I only made $18,000. So we've sacrificed to be able to do the work that we're doing, and we are actually starting to have different larger donors and companies reach out because they see that we're doing this work with bubblegum and shoe straps, and we're doing a hell of a job doing it, and they want to help us. So we gladly accept the help.
That's great. Yeah.
It really is.
So let me ask you something. You asked Sarah when she was thrown out of a window. Was that the point when you got sober? I wasn't clear on it.
Yeah, so that was 2017, and that was when I got sober and started Savage Sisters. But I did have, after starting Savage Sisters in 2019, I experienced a relapse.
Right.
So I have 3 years of continuous sobriety, but 5 years in recovery.
Okay.
And that was a weekend relapse after a mental health crisis, right, of losing your partner, and then you came right back in. And what was that like coming back in after the setback?
It was difficult, but I have an incredible family. I have a lot of support from them. I will say that I got a little bit of, there was some stigma and shame surrounding it that I had to deal with, but it really showed me, number one, it showed me that I wanted to be sober, because when I relapsed, I was seeking relief and I didn't get it from the relapse. So I just immediately didn't want to do that anymore. And number two, it showed me just how resilient we are as humans, that we can come back from anything. And I came back with a vengeance. So the past 3 years have been absolutely incredible, and the universe has been guiding me to do wonderful things that I would never be able to do if I had just ran 3 years ago.
Sure. Now, you have a child?
Two.
How old?
My son is 16 and my daughter's 9.
So how are they with all this? They're getting a good education, right?
They know everything that I do.
Right?
And they're amazing. They've, you know, the amends that I get to make to them is being there and being present, you know, making lunch in the morning.
Yeah.
And being able to wrap my arms around my son and just be there for him, because he had, you know, my kids were dragged up through that addiction.
Yeah.
So there's this incredible healing that takes place in this open, vulnerable space with my family and my children, and I'm married now. And so it's this great kind of balance in my life of the service work with Savage and this incredible family that I have and amazing support team that I have through our volunteers and like the people that work with me at Savage.
Do you worry about your kids becoming addicts?
Sometimes I think about it, but it's out of my control. I have no power over what they do with their lives. I do know that they're lucky to have a harm reductionist as a mom.
Yeah, right. That's right.
So.
Yeah, that still doesn't guarantee. I think about it all the time, you know, with the kids. Man, you know, apple doesn't fall far from the tree, you know, all that kind of stuff. Well, hopefully they'll be fine. I mean, you know, it really doesn't matter if even both parents are addicts. It doesn't mean the kids are going to be addicts at all.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, of course, we know there's a greater chance of it. But you know, you said it. You said, there's some things we don't have control over.
Yeah. And I wouldn't, you know, my mom's big famous line with me is you don't have to be sober to be loved. So it wouldn't change the dynamic of our relationship in any way. And my experiences with addiction and substance use and like mental health have made me, I think, somebody who can be an agent of change. And it's given me a divine purpose to help others like myself. I don't know what my children's journeys hold for them, but I will be there and I will love them and support them through every single thing that they experience.
You know, as you, just like we, you have credibility. Street credibility, because you've been through there. It's not like you're like, yeah, okay. It's not like you're, you know, reading out of a textbook.
Yeah.
I think when somebody likes like us starts to talk this stuff, people listen because they know it's for real, and that's, you know,
I would hope so. Our team is made up of people that have been, that are in recovery from homelessness and substance use disorder. And I want to keep it that way. I don't want a bunch of suits telling us what to do. We are uniquely qualified to do the work that we are doing, and we will continue to.
Yeah, that's good. Hey, you know who's watching us right now?
Who?
Who's from Conshohocken?
Mona McNally Popcorny.
All right.
I think we got it right. Now she's going to call and be like, no,
hey, yeah, Monica, why don't you
right.
call in? 1-800 – wait, what's the number here? 1-888-329-3306. That's 1-888-329-3306.
She was great as a guest, remember?
She came in with the judge, Montgomery County Judge Eisenberg.
Yeah, she was awesome.
Yeah, she was fabulous. Oh, we're going to a break? You're right. Hey, yes. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
Hi, this is Butch Patrick. That's right, TV's Eddie Munster, and everything is better with Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
1-888-329-3306 is the number. And if you're joining us via radio, if you're joining us via your telephone, your computer, how else can people do this? How else they watch?
I think you hit the ball. Right? Oh, podcast. We have an amazing podcast.
We definitely do. Yeah. And you know what's really wonderful? On Fridays, we can see a good amount of people who are listening and watching, and it makes you feel good. Let me see. Okay, David Serkin is watching. Got a lot of good comments here. Mike Hepp.
Oh, yeah. Mike Hepp, our buddy.
What's up, guys?
We still got to ride the race car.
I'm not getting in that race car.
Yeah, I don't think I am either.
I'm claustrophobic.
I think we would have problems, Gary.
Would you?
I think that I would not, I don't think. Maybe I would.
No, it'd be horrible if he had the race car, which he did in Atlantic City on the boardwalk, and he got in and something happened mechanically and it just took off into the ocean.
That would be your biggest nightmare. The guy that's afraid of sharks getting thrown in the ocean by this race car.
Yeah, this what that do you would say, 4,000 horsepower?
Yeah, yeah. I forget what the zero to 60 was.
12 miles out before it stalled out.
Yeah, you see,
Mike, is that right?
All the way out there.
You know, it's crazy stuff. All right, let's get back to our guest, Sarah Laurel. Sarah, how you doing, all right?
I'm fabulous.
Okay,
and
good.
She has not said one four-letter word.
I told her she could not curse for an hour, and she's great.
She was like, I don't know if I'm going to make it through the hour.
Well, she has so far. Don't jinx it.
Yeah, 10 minutes. 10 minutes.
10 more minutes. 10 more minutes. Right.
She's like, I could fill the hour with the four-letter words, but.
That's right. Let me see what else. You know, the article in the Philadelphia Inquirer talks about getting pulled over and what you should and shouldn't do. You know what? Rules of the road. Let me just a couple things real quick. Here's some really stupid questions.
Yeah.
Should cannabis users drive extra carefully? No. No. Is there a breathalyzer for pot? No, not yet.
There will be.
Now, this is an interesting question. Should I agree to a blood or urine test after being pulled over?
Absolutely not.
This is what this – okay. You might be right. It might make sense for a motorist to agree to a blood test if it's a first DUI offense. First-time offenders are eligible for rehabilitation programs that would lead to a year's probation, but a loss of license for just 60 days.
Well, I think that's for a blood test. But I remember Zach Cooper, our resident attorney, said that with breathalyzers, I believe that you automatically lose your license for a year.
One year in Pennsylvania.
If you refuse the breathalyzer.
That's right. One year. And oh, my God.
It's crazy. I mean, it's crazy. And yeah, so talk about some changes.
Sarah, what are your feelings on the legalization of marijuana?
I think it's wonderful. I think that it was necessary. I think that it released a lot of nonviolent drug offenders from the judicial system. And I think that it's going to bring a lot of money and jobs to our country. As far as them doing the breathalyzers and the checking and all that, like, that's above my pay grade. but I do think that we should be moving towards all of that kind of with all different substances, because then we remove the criminal element of drugs and create a safer environment for everyone involved.
Okay, well, we can agree to disagree.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I'm concerned about is the kids in the high schools right now, because they're getting so much pot and they're going to see their parents doing it. And, you know, I'm concerned.
In contrast to when it was illegal?
Well, they were still getting it then, but I think it's going to be like more present, you know, because there's so much of it out there right now.
Similar to how alcohol is.
Okay. Yeah. That's no good either, but, you know, I mean.
Right, but we know that prohibition has never limited children's access to anything. Statistically.
Okay, so.
Historically.
Heroin? Legal?
Opioids? Heroin? Yes, why not?
Yeah.
You
can't
get alcohol at the age of 15. You can't get heroin either. And also, nobody's asking permission to do heroin. They're doing it regardless, and they're consuming it in an unsafe manner. And it's getting stepped on with substances that are much more deadly. Like fentanyl.
Listen, that's what's so beautiful about this show. We don't have to agree on everything. If everybody agreed on everything, it'd be blank and boring.
Exactly. Exactly. And, yeah. And you know, and on that point, I think I've thought about this same thing with because there's some countries that do that sort of thing. They actually have prescription heroin, you know, and they don't have as many deaths and things like that. So it's definitely a complicated issue with two sides.
I think that we've already tried prohibition and it's failed miserably. The more we schedule narcotics, the more we talk about a war on drugs, the more dangerous it's become, the more overdose deaths that we are witnessing. So the way that we are attacking this right now is a failed, archaic model, and it needs to be revisited. And it needs to be revisited by individuals with new evidence-based practices and actual statistics around positive change.
One of our listeners, Nancy Minnick, has an interesting question. She wonders, how is the work that you're doing received by the dealers?
Oh, we love them. We give them Narcan, Naloxone. We engage with them. They don't have a problem with the work that we're doing because we aren't there to hurt. We're literally there to serve individuals.
But aren't you taking their customers away?
Why would we take them away? We're not there to take them away. We're meeting people where they're at and providing them with street-based supplies, clothing, food, shoes, Naloxone. And, you know, if they want treatment, we'll take them away. It's not a competitive nature between harm reductionists and dealers.
Okay.
It's dealers against dealers, I would say.
Okay.
Well, and so you're bridging this. One of the things we know as being a therapist is that rapport is your biggest thing. And so what you see is you get that rapport, and most of the time people are more likely to end up getting treatment if they have that rapport with somebody.
3 to 5 times more likely if they are inducted into a harm reduction program to seek out treatment.
Really? That's that's great. That's a big percentage.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I don't actually like look at drug dealers and think, oh, all drug dealers should go to prison. I think that if you look at Kensington in particular, and I am going to speak specifically to Kensington and Philadelphia, the individuals that are doing that street-based drug sale are marginalized, underemployed, exploited largely, and have zero resources and are trying to work, what, 3 jobs, making $7.25 an hour to feed a family? What's the system and the systematic problems that are forcing them to go to the street to deal with illegal ways to create an income for their family? This is systematic.
Okay.
Sorry.
Listen, it's fine. Sometimes we don't disagree, you know,
yeah.
And I'm usually right, but Mark goes along with it.
Well, and to Sarah's point, I mean, yeah. It's absolutely correct with the systematic, you know, the way there isn't the opportunities. And you could see, I mean, somebody wants to make $7.25 an hour and raise kids, and you know, it's a whole systematic issue.
Well, that's right. Yeah. It certainly is. I don't know we like to say, so where's this all going to go?
That's the problem. That is the problem, because it is not going in a good direction right now.
And build wealth within Kensington.
What'd you say, sir?
Build wealth within the community, the residential community. Offer them jobs. If you're a drug dealer in Kensington, you know numbers. You know how to add and subtract. You're good on your feet. You're pretty crafty.
Stigma.
Give them job opportunities. Raise the minimum wage. Give them the opportunity to support their family in a non-illegal way. Support that community by giving them the things that we have out on the main line. Why isn't it offered in that area? And then you create this environment where they're proud of their community and their neighborhood, and you create a culture of building wealth together, and that. That's a different culture. That's something that we haven't done there.
That's right. You're right. That's real long term. But for the people that are struggling right now all over the country, I think they need treatment. And I guess a lot of them aren't willing to get it, but they need access to treatment. I agree with you, Sarah, on the larger picture about the economy, the jobs. But, you take Kensington. What do you got, one? All right, we got one. Listen, it was a good discussion, and you had a lot of great points.
Awesome.
No, it was awesome.
Yeah.
It's great. You would have to agree. It'd be ridiculous. A lot of the things you said, we do agree.
Okay.
We absolutely do. Hey, so remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. Please call 1-800-662-HELP, 1-800-662-HELP. For Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
I'm Mark Sigmund.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about this broadcast, please join us on our mission at cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com.
Everybody is a star.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
System tries to break.